Isn't it good that at least Muslims believe that Jesus was a prophet? But that is a lie about Jesus. It is false faith.
Okay, yeah, yes.
It's not a stepping stone. It's an instantiation of the idol worship of, because Jesus has revealed who he truly is. Yeah. And I think that's important in terms of there has to be, yes, a connection, but there has to be a confrontation.
Hello and welcome to Independence, the FIAC podcast. Great that you can join us. My name is Adrian Reynolds. I'm the Associate National Director for the FIAC. And I'm here today with two schoolmates.
Me.
It's not, that makes it sound like we went to some posh boarding school, which is as far from the truth as it's possible to be. But these are three Southend lads coming to you on the podcast today. Southend, to give it its proper name. Dan, you're a Southend lad.
I am, born and bred, Southend, yeah.
Yeah, I was not born in South. I was born in Colchester, but brought up in Southend. So Southend is in my DNA. And Dan, just tell us where you are now and what you're doing.
Yeah, I'm the director of Crosslands Forum, the academic director of Crosslands Training, and I've been doing that for 4 years, yeah.
Great. Well, welcome, Southender. And another Southender, although he would say Leon C, which is like the posh boy of Southend, really. Rob Scott. Hello, Rob.
Hi, nice to be here. Thanks for inviting
me. And you are genuinely Southend born.
Yeah, absolutely. Born and bred, as was my father. But yes, don't have the accent, not quite sure.
So why. I'm basically the outsider.
Yeah.
Dan's the only one that's got the accent now.
Yeah, exactly.
Mine, Dan, I don't know if I've ever told you this, was literally beaten out of me by an elocution teacher. I was sent to elocution lessons because my mother, who had ideas, I'm not going to get into trouble with my mum. There we are. Rob, tell us what you're doing now.
I helped to lead a small church in East London, in Tower Hamlets, that meets in Sylheti language and in English language. And Sylheti is a heart language for many of the Bangladeshi people that live in our area.
So Sylheti is an area. Sylhet is an area within Bangladesh, right?
Yep.
So it's a place within a place, and it has its own distinct language. And you learned that language, Rob, you and your family. Just tell us how you went about doing that.
Yeah, in 2011 to 2013, me, my wife and our three children, we went to Sylhet to try and learn as much Sylheti language as possible in as short a time as possible, to come back here to be able to speak about Jesus with these people in the language they could understand. We'd been doing various bits of outreach and had relationships, had meetings with mosques, and we'd often be talking very explicitly about Jesus in English and then find out afterwards that no one understood what we said. So we thought it's important to learn their language and important for them to be able to hear Jesus in their language and not see him as a Western person.
Now, we were all at school together, although saying we were at school together is not quite the full story, because you're either thinking Adrian's got old before his time, or you're thinking Rob and Dan have, you know, the years have not been kind to them. So you're both much younger than I think I probably clipped you around the ears in an age when you were allowed to do that,
well,
didn't
you were, I? You were a senior prefect.
Captain.
Is that
captain.
Right? Yeah.
And, okay. And then Rob and I were in the same tutor group. And because in those days you were called by your surname, Scott and Strange were kind of together. Although, as I always say, Rob and I didn't really hang out. I went to the Christian Union. Rob played football.
Yep.
How the tables have turned.
Terrible. And we both went off to university. And I thought, well, Dan's not going to be a Christian after doing theology. And he saw me to go to university and thought I was never a Christian anyway. And here we are.
So there we are. And can we just make a little plug? Southend needs the gospel.
Yes.
Desperate need of churches. So I don't know, in the greater Southend area, 350,000 people, something like that.
Yeah.
And in terms of churches, very, very little going on.
Yes.
So we have a real heart for it, don't we? We'd love to see.
And remember, it's a city now.
So yes, that's right. It is a city.
All the city analysis can... kind of, you know,
exactly right. Now, the reason I mentioned school, we're here today not to talk about school, you might be surprised to know, to talk about reaching Muslims, which seems a bit crazy, but we've all got a little bit of skin in the game for different reasons, which we will explain. Rob, obviously so, but we all have a heart to see people reach with the gospel, all kinds of people from all different kinds of backgrounds. I think it's fair to say, I knew one Muslim when I was growing up, and he was very, very nominal. Is that kind of your experience as well, growing up in Southend?
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't think I knew any. But interestingly, having done one meeting at East London Mosque back in the noughties, someone came forward who said he was at Southend High with us a few years below and can remember, certainly me, remember Dan as well. So that was one guy. But yeah, not at all.
A few years below, so he wouldn't have known me. So I'm off the hook. We're talking about reaching Muslims, and what's clear is that the situation is rapidly changing. Wherever you live, the situation is rapidly changing at slightly different rates in different places. So here's just a few facts and figures just to set the scene. 2021, the last census, 6% of the UK population would say they were followers of Islam. That's 4 million people. Now, that varies considerably depending on where you are. So Greater London, where you are, Rob, and where I lived for 8 years, we lived just around the corner from one another in East London. 15% of people would say they were Muslims, 1.3 million people. If you go north of the border into Scotland, it's 2.2%, same in Wales. Northern Ireland, 0.6%. So a lot smaller there, but things are changing. I guess the northeast, Dan, you're in the northeast. I guess there'll be pockets of Muslim presence, but I guess especially in some of the rural areas, it's a bit more scattered.
But then the other week I went to speak in I've been in Burnley and Bradford, and there, you know, you've got 30%. And
yeah,
so
sure.
Very,
sure.
Very different. And so, yeah but in the northeast, very different from London. Yeah.
Yeah. Now, Dan, I'm interested to hear from you a little bit and Rob too on this. My experience of living in East London, we were there for 8 years. Our children grew up there during that time. They were at school during that time, and our youngest daughter was at a school that was 90% Muslim, I guess. But my experience of that, and this surprises some people, is that was a very easy place to be a Christian. Now, what I mean by that is we found it easy to talk about faith. Faith was normalized. It was a part of life. And so even though I had a different faith from others, it was easier, well, let's say easier to talk about faith with people. And my daughter would say it was relatively easy to be a Christian at a school that was predominantly Muslim. So there was no aggressive secular agenda. There were no LGBT lessons or kind of stuff being marketed. And she would say, surprisingly, it didn't feel like you were a fish out of water because you had faith. She didn't feel that friends got at her and that kind of thing. So obviously there are challenges, but she found it easier than people who perhaps haven't lived in that environment expected. Is that your experience as well, Rob? You've been in the East End longer than I was ever in the East End. Is that partly your experience too?
I think to an extent, yes. So we've had three children grow up here. Our youngest is now in year 13. Our older two left home university now or beyond. Certainly just the experience of our youngest at the moment in a mixed comprehensive school around the corner from us. He's having lots of conversations about his faith. He is asked difficult questions about it, but he doesn't find it hard to be a Christian and hold to those Christian values because everyone else is holding some kind of religious values. And actually the school, it's a secular school, but it doesn't promote it, but it's also very aware that everyone has a religion. And so he's keen to give everyone a voice. And both his experience and our girls actually in RE lessons particularly, but those were really good opportunities to speak about their faith. And they were given, it was meant to be a safe place for doing that. And it really was. I think some of the questions that my son gets are different from what you might get in a secular place, obviously, whether it's about sexuality or about the existence of God altogether. It's more about Trinity and the corruption of the Bible not. So we do have to equip him for that. But he's had many more opportunities than certainly I had growing up.
Yeah. And that felt different from school for me. I mean, I was called Christian Aid at school, which then when the AIDS crisis hit, turned into Christian AIDS, which was never very pleasant. But I mean, I just remember being, I guess, teased is not quite strong enough a word, but basically being mocked for being a Christian. It was a bit of a weird thing. Was that your experience, Dan?
Yeah. Oh, completely. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think I probably... even before I was converted, because I just went to church, that was that was very, very normal to have that kind of.
So I guess what I'm saying is, deep in my heart, I'm thinking, you know, I wouldn't articulate this because I'm a pastor, so I'd be careful about how I say it, but I would be thinking, well, Islam isn't so bad.
Yeah,
you know, actually, it's that there are things about it that there seems to be upside in terms of an environment in which to grow up in. So I need to keep reminding myself, don't I, Dan, about the lostness of People with faith, without faith, whoever they are, but that we need to constantly remind ourselves about that, don't we?
Yeah, and I think there's an enlightenment, or I suppose a modernist lie that we kind of go along with the idea, and of course this is very much the case in public discourse, that there are people of faith, of which we are there with Muslims and Hindus and Buddhists or whatever, and there are people of no faith. And the problem with that is that just is thoroughly anti-biblical, and the Bible's perspective from Genesis 3 onwards is that there are people who believe in the one true God, and then there are people, the Reformed scholastic Francis Turretin talks about people who have false faith. The idea that when Adam and Eve when they disbelieve in God, it's not simply they're disbelieving in God, they're imputing lies about him. They're saying false things about him.
Right.
And so really the only distinction, the most important theological distinction in human beings, is do we have true faith or false faith? And when you cut it like that, then Islam is as false a faith as any other false faith. The complexity that Islam brings, though, I think, is probably because in the history of the West, historically, Islam was never treated as another religion. It was always treated as a Christian heresy.
Okay.
So in Dante's Inferno, Muhammad gets his own kind of sub-circle of hell, while the pagans are further outside. And again, I think that does make it, that makes it a bit more specialized. On one level, I want to say our evangelism to Muslims is no different from any other. You know, they're made in the image of God. They've suppressed the truth. They're idolaters. They need to turn to faith in Christ. On the other hand, though, I do think given there is a coherent worldview that they present, that does mean, I suppose, specialist ways in which that idolatry manifests itself. But at the end of the day, they need the Lord Jesus Christ as much as anyone else. And the key thing is, that idea of let's not get sucked into that people of faith and no faith. It's false faith and truth faith. And
that's helpful. It's wrong for me to think then, isn't it? If we really understand conversion and what's going on in conversion, it's wrong for me to think that it's harder for a Muslim to be converted than someone who isn't. That's not the right category, is it, Dan? That's not biblical. No. Yeah.
And it's also thinking, and I think this sometimes is that, well, isn't it good that at least Muslims believe that Jesus was a prophet? But that is a lie about Jesus. It is false faith.
Okay, yeah, yes.
It's not a stepping stone. It's an instantiation of the idol worship of, because Jesus has revealed who he truly is. Yeah. And I think that's important in terms of there has to be, yes, a connection, but there has to be a confrontation. And the same, at the end of the day, you don't need a different theology or anthropology or doctrine of salvation or evangelism when you're engaging Muslims. It's exactly the same. Yes, it's tailored to the questions and the issues that they have, but it's the same thing that's going on.
That's really helpful, thank you. And we need to help our people in our church see that as well, don't they? So, you know, we're thinking about these things, we're trying to think about them spiritually, but actually we've got to lead our churches in that. I guess, Rob, the other thing that I had to learn when I moved to East London, and that this was just my naivety and ignorance, I think, is to think of Islam as one big block. So you know, we talk about 4 million Muslims in the UK, and there are similarities, but there are significant differences between there are cultural differences, there are faith differences, aren't there, between Muslims. Not every Muslim is the same as every other Muslim.
No, absolutely. And I think in terms of Britain, I think a helpful difference at a very basic level is newly arrived or established community. And going back to whether some Muslims are too hard to reach with the gospel, actually, newly arrived Muslims seem to be swarming into churches in amazing ways. And I was at a meeting last Saturday in a church that was 30 people had grown to 90, with that extra 60 largely being people from Iranian, Kurdish, Afghan background.
How extraordinary.
Starting following Jesus. Are we seeing that amongst Sylheti Bangladeshis in Tower Hamlets? Not so much. But even amongst the 100,000 Sylheti Bangladeshis, there's great variety, depending on when and how they arrived, what education they've had, whether they do buy into our radical agenda or not, whether they are more concerned just for their kids' education to do well in the world rather than actually whether they go to a madrasa. All different kinds of people, just like there are in the rest.
And presumably tied up in national identity too, because there's no love lost between Bangladesh and Pakistan, is there, because of the history there?
Because of the War of Independence in 71. Yeah. But then some people are saying that was an error because we should all be Muslims together and in one big empire.
Hmm. Is it helpful, Dan, to think, I mean, it's not dissimilar to Christianity in a way. I mean, people might identify as Christian, but might have all kind of different, they might mean all kinds of different things by that, mightn't they?
Yeah, and I think it's interesting, the fragmentation. I mean, what's hard about this discussion is that even within evangelical belief, there are brothers and sisters of ours. On the one hand, there's the kind of the narrative that says there is a big Islamic conspiracy that we're going to be Islamified in 5 years. And then there's the other view that says actually nothing to see here is absolutely fine. Now, without kind of doing a third wayism, I am going to do a third wayism because I do think that I do think there is that there is something about the theology of Islam in terms of, well, you become like the gods that you worship. If you worship Allah, a monad, oneness, the society that you reflect back over time, if you're consistent, is, I would say, antithetical to a Christian understanding of unity and diversity in all kinds of different ways, including how we build society. Mm. On the other hand, probably the fragmentation or the different types of Islam means that there probably isn't some kind of coordinated plan. Having said that, I think because Islam is a kind of, I think nation states have always struggled to deal with Islam because I do think their first loyalty is often not to the nation state, it is to Mecca. Mm. And I think that's always been a problem. And I think that's a problem that we're facing at the moment in terms of identity, nationhood, immigration, integration, what does it mean to be British? And these are things that I think, you know, we said this before the podcast, it's not as if these are new issues. We've been talking about these for ages. We've been, you know, going around in circles on it. At the moment, it is a very particular issue and I do think pretty incendiary, but these are the things that we need to be.
So there's nothing new, is there? I mean, yeah. Rob, you were telling me earlier that even when you were a little whippersnapper at school, you know, this was something that you were talking about and interesting to see the reactions. Just tell us that story about Salman Rushdie.
As we've said, there weren't many people of other ethnicities, let alone Muslim people at the school, but it was the Salman Rushdie crisis saga that kind of made us aware of Muslim people, his book being burned in Bradford and elsewhere. And I can remember it was a time of GCSEs and doing my English oral on this particular topic and not really understanding why people should burn his book at all. That's what's going on here. It's just wrong. And then using the example that another guy, I think from a Kurdish background at the time, 1989-90, he decided to try and burn down a mosque in response. And what was wrong with that? And this whole discussion and all part of my English oral, and nobody really had an understanding of what was going on in any way, but thought, yeah, if people want to burn something, we should do something back, which is clearly wrong.
Yeah, it's fascinating, isn't it? And that sort of thoughtlessness carries on. That's no different, is it? But I think it behoves us as Christians to be thoughtful and to be careful about how we talk about these things and how we speak in them. So we understand the need to reach Muslims. But help me out here, Rob. You know, I'm just down the road from Leicester, first city in Britain to be majority non-white, 33% Muslim, for people from all kinds of different backgrounds. So I'm just down the road from Leicester. And when I first moved to Market Harbour, it was a bit like Southend when we were growing up. It was 99% white. Now, interestingly, that's changing very, very rapidly, very, very rapidly. And our church is changing, the area is changing. So I'm beginning to think, you know, how do we reach the growing number of Muslims that are around us? But I don't even know where to start. I don't, you know, it feels like such an overwhelming task. I guess a bit like you were saying earlier, Dan, it feels like an impossible task because I'm thinking to myself, actually, a Muslim is harder to reach than, you know, the person who lives next door to me has got the same cultural background as me. So Rob, how do I even make a start with this?
I think recognizing something of what Dan began with, that everybody is made in God's image, and that's true for Muslim people too, as anybody else. And everyone is fallen and therefore needs to hear the gospel. We've got to keep preaching that to ourselves. Made in God's image, therefore worthy of respect and honor and dignity, just like everybody else. Fallen, and so needs to hear of Jesus, just like everybody else. Understand that their suppressions of truth, their false faith, will be slightly different from other people. But find out what those suppressions are. I think it's asking people questions about what their life is like. Certainly we found here, and I think probably did Adrian in East London, that people are very happy to talk about their faith, albeit a false faith. And it's good to find out from them so you can then apply the gospel particularly to them. I think sometimes we can, that there are barriers, we can feel hard to reach because it can be hard for a Muslim person to walk through the doors of your church. But if we just think of bringing people to church as the only way we're reaching people, then that's a little bit narrow.
And that will be narrow in a lot of areas, actually, not just reaching Muslims.
No, sure. I agree. And obviously, we want the church to be the beacon of light, the witness in the community, the place where people do experience and see God's love. And there's a sign that the powers and authorities outside. But we also need to be going out for people who are not coming in. And that might be as small a thing as just talking to the Pakistani taxi driver, Uber driver that gives you a lift. Oh, are you a Muslim? What does that mean for you? What do you know about Christian things? And they'll obviously get everything off their chest they might think about Christianity, but it might give you an opportunity to exchange numbers. We should talk about this some more. Or when you go for a curry, it'll probably be a Bangladeshi Sylheti person serving you, because most curry houses are Sylheti run. Or encouraging your children at school to be bold with their classmates and just say to them, what did they do at the weekend? Like you would with anybody else. And we went to church. Do you know what church is? We shouldn't see people in as different in that way and hard to talk with. And I think a lot of it, though, is in helping us to get over any fear we might have of either causing them offence or fear that we'll be overheard by secularists who say that we're messing things up in some kind of social cohesion type way. Mm. Need to get over any fear and also any loathing that we might feel that they have come to take over our space. Now, some Muslim people might think like that, but very few. But even if they do, they still need to hear about Jesus, and we need to be encouraging one another to get over our fear and possible loathing to speak with them. Yeah. It's often better doing it together as well, not just on our own. Mm.
You, that's really helpful, Rob. You mentioned earlier on, when you're talking about your son at school, some of the touchstone issues that kind of people were talking about. Just tell us what those were briefly.
If we were to kind of, you could something. Broad brush, 1.6 billion Muslim people across the world. You can't generalize, but let's generalize.
Yes, let's.
They would ordinarily have four objections to what we believe, at least, if not more. First of all, Jesus is not God, not Son of God. He's not divine in any way. As Dan said, he's prophet, but he's much more than prophet, isn't he? But they say he's not Son of God, the first thing. The Trinity is just wrong. There's only a oneness of God. The Trinity is illogical. Third thing, that Jesus didn't die, the Quran says that. Now, so the Quran says all of those things, that Jesus isn't the Son, that the Trinity is wrong in some way, and that he didn't die. The fourth big objection that Muslims people would have is the Bible's being corrupt. Now, they have to say that because the Bible teaches that Jesus is divine, that he did die, sure. And the Trinity is true. But I don't think the Quran actually says that. So it's within their religion, it's consistent, but inconsistent idea. So we've got to have an answer to those things. Now, certainly on issues of Trinity, and the Western Church hasn't really done much thinking on it since the 5th century. We haven't really taught people, particularly whether it's young or old, but we need to rejoice in the fact that our God is Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, and say that while that's been the case from the beginning through the middle to the end of the Bible, and it's not just something made up by Constantine or Paul, and equip our young disciples as much as our old disciples to say that. I think we're probably better at talking about Jesus' death and resurrection. We're usually unapologetic about that. The divinity and humanity of Jesus we're less good at speaking about, because again, we don't think about it quite so much, but showing how he is truly God, fully God and fully man. Because often Muslim people think that we are saying that the wholeness of God is Jesus. And so if Jesus is on the earth, well, where is God? Because they only think in oneness terms. And if Jesus ate and slept, and went to the toilet. How can he be God? And so we need to hold on to his full humanity as long as his, as well as his full divinity, and best explain from the Gospels how that comes about.
It's fascinating, Dan, because that they're quite theological subjects that I think leaders are not often very good at articulating themselves.
No,
you know, as part of their preaching or part, you know, we worship a Trinitarian God. How does that shape your praying on a Sunday morning, the songs you're choosing, you know, the things you're saying in your sermons? And also this whole question about confidence in the Bible. You know, we it's not corrupt. We all have different translations. What about the differences? So the pastor does need to be a theologian, doesn't he?
Yeah, and yeah, definitely. I mean, yes, of course.
Yes.
And also, I think the things that often, I think in more kind of liberal ecumenical circles, the idea is well, you need to focus on the things that unite rather than divide. But in our evangelism, we need to be focusing on those things that are points of difference. That's absolutely crucial. And just to say, you know, Rob wouldn't have said it, but his little book, Sharing the Gospel with a Muslim Neighbor, is brilliant. If you want a very helpful book, practical book about how to do that, then please get Rob's book from 10 of Those, published a few years ago now. It's brilliant.
You've written a book about other faiths. That's much more complicated.
Well, yeah, but yes, but that's about how Christians' approach to other religions in general, of which Islam is one, of course.
It's like,
even if you call it a religion.
You're doing a seminar on that, which I'm looking forward to at the Leaders Conference. Yes. It's a bit like Greg Beale, who wrote a big commentary on Revelation. Then someone wrote a version for Duffers based on his work. Someone needs to write a version for Duffers of Dan's doctoral work, and then I'll be in clover. Listen, folks, we're almost out of time, but we've got a seminar track at the Leaders Conference, and if you're listening to this and the Leaders Conference is gone, sorry, you've missed it. But if you're able to come along, we'd love to see you at the track at the Leaders Conference. That's three sessions. You sign up for the three sessions, and over those three sessions, Rob, we're going to be thinking about what it means to reach Muslims, trying to understand Islam in Britain. That's right, isn't it? And some of the context and the politics behind it all, what shaped it, and to begin to think a little bit about how to reach Muslims. Just tell us a bit more about what that track's going to entail, Rob.
So it's not going to be how to share your faith with a Muslim neighbour.
Okay. You've written the book already. The book's there. Dan's given the plug.
But we want to help church leaders to think about how they can encourage their churches and everybody to be involved in this kind of thing, not least in a Britain that seems to have changed quite rapidly. Now, whether it has or not, but how we deal with that and think into that and pray into that as well as acting. Now, that will obviously involve evangelism. We want that to be an outbox, but it's not the only one. Yeah. So we're going to be thinking about some of the stats, some of the things on migration. One of the seminars led by a Pakistani man and a white woman will be looking at grooming gangs and issues that to do with that. And the lady that's leading that, she should have been here, but she's had to look after her mother. She would very much echo Dan's point about focus on the differences. That really shows what the gospel is about.
We also say, by the way, that might be triggering for some people. So do be careful attending that. Yeah. So we've got to talk about these things, haven't we? If we want to understand Islam in Britain, these are some of the topics that are important for us to grapple with.
And if we don't talk about them, others are. And certainly our congregations are thinking about them or hearing about them. And we need to provide a Christian answer to some of these things. The lady involved in giving that second seminar has done a lot of work with at Speaker's Corner, very boldly in debating and in mosques, but also got relational approaches to Muslim people as well. Mm. And it's very good from that point of view.
Brilliant.
And then we're going to have a panel as well, just to bring up all the questions that we haven't dealt with that people can ask. And hopefully we can provide a little bit of wisdom.
Great. Well, listen, guys, thank you very much for your wisdom. I really appreciate it. I feel this should be a new podcast series, The Three Amigos. Which is just the three of us, you know, reminiscing about Southend and spiritual life.
Can't we just call it Jog On?
There we are. That's a rather frivolous end to a very important subject. Yes. But thank you for joining us. I do appreciate your wisdom. And both of you, I really love and value for what you know, the way you're serving the kingdom, and not just locally, but the wider kingdom. I've benefited from wisdom from both of you. So thank you so much. And the Lord bless you in your work. This has been Independence. Thanks for watching, for listening, and I hope to catch up with you soon.